run through the items. He has a day 3 checklist, for example, which he and his team review at the end of the third day of considering an investment. By that point, the checklist says, they should confirm that they have gone over the prospect's key financial statements for the previous 10 years, including specifically checking for items in each statement and possible patterns across the statements. It's easy to hide in a statement. It's hard to hide between statements, Cook said. One check, for example, requires the members of the team to verify that they've read the footnotes on the cash flow statements. Another has them confirm they've reviewed the statement of key management risks. A third asks them to make sure they've looked to see whether cash flow and costs match the reported revenue growth. This is basic, 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 he said. Just look. You'd be amazed by how often people don't do it. Consider the Enron debacle, he said. People could have figured out it was a disaster entirely from the financial statements. He told me about one investment he looked at that seemed a huge winner. The cocaine brain was screaming. It turned out, however, that the company's senior officers, who'd been selling prospective investors on how great their business was, had quietly sold every share they owned. The company was about to tank, and buyers jumping aboard had no idea. But Cook had put a check on his 3-day list that ensured his team had reviewed the fine print of the company's mandatory stock disclosures, and he discovered the secret. 49 times out of 50, he said, there's nothing to be found. But then, there is. The checklist doesn't tell him what to do, he explained. It is not a formula, but the checklist helps him be as smart as possible every step of the way, ensuring that he's got the critical information he needs when he needs it, that he's systematic about decision-making, that he's talked to everyone he should. With a good checklist in hand, he was convinced he and his partners could make decisions as well as human beings are able. As a result, he was also convinced they could reliably beat the market. I asked him whether he wasn't fooling himself. Maybe, he said, but he put it in surgical terms for me. When surgeons make sure to wash their hands or to talk to everyone on the team, he'd seen the surgery checklist. They improve their outcomes with no increase in skill. That's what we are doing when we use the checklist. Cook would not discuss precise results. His fund does not disclose its earnings publicly. But he said he had already seen the checklist deliver better outcomes for him. He had put the checklist process in place at the start of 2008, and at a minimum, it appeared that he had been able to ride out the subsequent economic collapse without disaster. Others say his fund has done far better than that, outperforming its peers. How much of any success can be directly credited to the checklist is not clear. After all, he's used it just 2 years so far. What Cook says is certain, however, was that in a period of enormous volatility, the checklist gave his team at least one additional and unexpected edge over others. Efficiency. When he first introduced the checklist, he assumed it would slow his team down, increasing the time and work required for their investment decisions. He was prepared to pay that price. The benefits of making fewer mistakes seemed obvious. And in fact, using the checklist did increase the upfront work time. But to his surprise, he found they were able to evaluate many more investments in far less time overall. Before the checklist, Cook said, it sometimes took weeks and multiple meetings to sort out how seriously they should consider a candidate investment, whether they should drop it or pursue a more in-depth investigation. The process was open-ended and haphazard, and when people put a month into researching an investment, they tended to get, well, invested. After the checklist, though, he and his team found that they could consistently sort out, by the 3-day check, which prospects really deserved further consideration and which ones didn't. The process was more thorough, but faster, he said. It was one hit, and we could move on. Pabry and Speer, the Zurich investor, found the same phenomenon. Speer used to employ an investment analyst, but I didn't need him anymore, he said. Pabrai had been working with the checklist for about a year. His fund was up more than 100% since then. This could not possibly be attributed to just the checklist. With the checklist in place, however, he observed that he could move through investment decisions far faster and more methodically. As the markets plunged through late 2008 and stockholders dumped shares in panic, there were numerous deals to be had, and in a single quarter, he was able to investigate more than 100 companies and add 10 to his fund's portfolios. Without the checklist, Pabrai said, he could not have gotten through a fraction of the analytic work or have had the confidence to rely on it. A year later, his investments were up more than 160% on average. He'd made no mistakes at all. What makes these investors' experiences striking to me is not merely their evidence that checklists might work as well in finance as they do in medicine. It's that here, too, they have found takers hard to find. In the money business, everyone looks for an edge. If someone is doing well, people pounce like starved hyenas to find out how. Almost every idea for making even slightly more money, investing in internet companies, buying tranches of sliced-up mortgages, whatever, gets sucked up by the giant maw almost instantly. Every idea, that is, except one. Checklists. I asked Cook how much interest others have had in what he has been doing these past 2 years. Zero, he said. Or actually, that's not quite true. People have been intensely interested in what he's been buying and how, but the minute the word checklist comes out of his mouth, they disappear. Even in his own firm, he's found it a hard sell. I got pushback from everyone. It took my guys months to finally see the value, he said. To this day, his partners still don't all go along with his approach and don't use the checklist in their decisions when he's not involved. I find it amazing other investors have not even bothered to try, he said. Some have asked. None have done it. The resistance is perhaps an inevitable response. Some years ago, Jeff Smart, a PhD psychologist who was then at Claremont Graduate University, conducted a revealing research project. He studied 51 venture capitalists, people who make gutsy, high-risk, multi-million-dollar investments in unproven startup companies. Their work is quite unlike that of money managers like Pabrai and Cook and Spear, who invest in established companies with track records and public financial statements one can analyze. Venture capitalists bet on wild-eyed, greasy-haired, underaged entrepreneurs, pitching ideas that might be little more than scribbles on a sheet of paper or a clunky prototype that barely works. But that's how Google and Apple started out, and the desperate belief of venture capitalists is that they can find the next equivalent and own it. Smart specifically studied how such people made their most difficult decision in judging whether to give an entrepreneur money or not. You would think that this would be whether the entrepreneur's idea is actually a good one or not. But finding a good idea is apparently not all that hard. Finding an entrepreneur who can execute a good idea is a different matter entirely. One needs a person who can take an idea from proposal to reality, work the long hours, build a team, handle the pressures and setbacks, manage technical and people problems alike, and stick with the effort for years on end without getting distracted or going insane. Such people are rare and extremely hard to spot. Smart identified half a dozen different ways the venture capitalists he studied decided whether they'd found such a person. These were styles of thinking, really. He called one type of investor the art critics. They assessed entrepreneurs almost at a glance, the way an art critic can assess the quality of a painting, intuitively and based on long experience. Sponges took more time gathering information about their targets, soaking up whatever they could from interviews, on-site visits, references, and the like. Then they went with whatever their gut told them. As one such investor told Smart, he did due diligence by mucking around. The prosecutors interrogated entrepreneurs aggressively, testing them with challenging questions about their knowledge and how they would handle random hypothetical situations. Suitors focused more on wooing people than on evaluating them. Terminators saw the whole effort as doomed to failure and skipped the evaluation part. They simply bought out what they thought were the best ideas, fired entrepreneurs they found to be incompetent, and hired replacements. Then there were the investors Smart called the airline captains. They took a methodical, checklist-driven approach to their task, studying past mistakes and lessons from others in the field. They built formal checks into their process. They forced themselves to be disciplined and not to skip steps, even when they found someone they knew intuitively was a real prospect. Smart next tracked the venture capitalist's success over time. There was no question which style was most effective, and by now you should be able to guess which one. It was the airline captain, hands down. Those taking the checklist-driven approach had a 10% likelihood of later having to fire senior management for incompetence or concluding that their original evaluation was inaccurate. The others had at least a 50% likelihood. The results showed up in their bottom lines, too. The airline captains had a median 80% return on the investments studied, the others 35% or less. Those with other styles were not failures by any stretch. Experience does count for something. But those who added checklists to their experience proved substantially more successful. The most interesting discovery was that despite the advantages, most investors were either art critics or sponges, intuitive decision makers instead of systematic analysts. Only 1 in 8 took the airline captain approach. Now, maybe the others didn't know about the airline captain approach, but even knowing seems to make little difference. Smart published his findings more than a decade ago. He has gone on to explain them in a best-selling business book on hiring called Who? But when I asked him, now that the knowledge is out, whether the proportion of major investors taking the more orderly, checklist-driven approach has increased substantially, he could only report, no, it's the same. We don't like checklists. They can be painstaking. They're not much fun. But I don't think the issue here is mere laziness. There's something deeper, more visceral going on when people walk away not only from saving lives, but from making money. It somehow feels beneath us to use a checklist, an embarrassment. It runs counter to deeply held beliefs about how the truly great among us, those we aspire to be, handle situations of high stakes and complexity. The truly great are daring. They improvise. They do not have protocols and checklists. Maybe our idea of heroism needs updating. On January 14, 2009, WHO's Safe Surgery Checklist was made public. As it happened, the very next day, U.S. Airways Flight 1549 took off from LaGuardia Airport in New York City, with 155 people on board, struck a large flock of Canadian geese over Manhattan, lost both engines, and famously crash-landed in the icy Hudson River. The fact that not a single life was lost led the press to christen the incident the Miracle on the Hudson. A National Transportation Safety Board official said the flight has to go down as the most successful ditching in aviation history. 57-year-old Captain Chesley B. Sully Sullenberger III, a former Air Force pilot with 20,000 hours of flight experience, was hailed the world over. "Quiet air hero is Captain America," shouted the New York Post headline. ABC News called him the Hudson River hero. The German papers hailed Der Held von New York. The French, Le Nouveau Héros de l'Amérique. The Spanish-language press, El Héro de Nueva York. President George W. Bush phoned Sullenberger to thank him personally, and President-elect Barack Obama invited him and his family to attend his inauguration 5 days later. Photographers tore up the lawn of his Danville, California home, trying to get a glimpse of his wife and teenage children. He was greeted with a hometown parade and a $3 million book deal. But as the details trickled out about the procedures and checklists that were involved, the fly-by-wire computer system that helped control the glide down to the water, the co-pilot who shared flight responsibilities, the cabin crew who handled the remarkably swift evacuation, we the public started to become uncertain about exactly who the hero here was. As Sullenberger kept saying over and over from the first of his interviews afterward, "I want to correct the record right now. This was a crew effort." The outcome, he said, was the result of teamwork and adherence to procedure as much as of any individual skill he may have had. "Aw, that's just the modesty of the quiet hero," we finally insisted. The next month, when the whole crew of five, not just Sullenberger, was brought out to receive the keys to New York City for exclusive interviews on every network, and for a standing ovation by an audience of 70,000 at the Super Bowl in Tampa Bay, you could see the press had already determined how to play this. They didn't want to talk about teamwork and procedure. They wanted to talk about Sully using his experience flying gliders as an Air Force Academy cadet. "That was so long ago," Sullenberger said, "and those gliders are so different from a modern jet airliner. I think the transfer of experience was not large." It was as if we simply could not process the full reality of what had been required to save the people on that plane. The aircraft was a European-built Airbus A320 with two jet engines, one on each wing. The plane took off at 3:25 p.m. on a cold but clear afternoon, headed for Charlotte, North Carolina, with First Officer Jeffrey Skiles at the controls and Sullenberger serving as the pilot not flying. The first thing to note is that the two had never flown together before that trip. Both were tremendously experienced. Skiles had nearly as many flight hours as Sullenberger and had been a long-time Boeing 737 captain until downsizing had forced him into the right-hand seat and retraining to fly A320s. This much experience may sound like a good thing, but it isn't necessarily. Imagine two experienced but unacquainted lawyers meeting to handle your case on your opening day in court. Or imagine two top basketball coaches, who are complete strangers, stepping onto the parquet to lead a team in a championship game. Things could go fine, but it is more likely that they will go badly. Before the pilot started the plane's engines at the gate, however, they adhered to a strict discipline, the kind most other professions avoid. They ran through their checklists. They made sure they'd introduced themselves to each other and the cabin crew. They did a short briefing, discussing the plan for the flight, potential concerns, and how they'd handle troubles if they ran into them. And by adhering to this discipline, by taking just those few short minutes, they not only made sure the plane was fit to travel, but also transformed themselves from individuals into a team, one systematically prepared to handle whatever came their way. I don't think we recognize how easy it would have been for Sullenberger and Skiles to have blown off those preparations, to have cut corners that day. The crew had more than 150 total years of flight experience. 150 years of running their checklists over and over and over, practicing them in simulators, studying the annual updates. The routine can seem pointless most of the time. Not once had any of them been in an airplane accident. They fully expected to complete their careers without experiencing one either. They considered the odds of anything's going wrong extremely low, far lower than we do in medicine or investment or legal practice or other fields. But they ran through their checks anyway. It need not have been this way. As recently as the 1970s, some airline pilots remain notoriously bluff about their preparations, however carefully designed. "I've never had a problem," they would say, or, "Let's get going, everything's fine," or, "I'm the captain, this is my ship, and you're wasting my time." Consider, for example, the infamous 1977 Tenerife disaster. It was the deadliest accident in aviation history. Two Boeing 747 airliners collided at high speed in fog on a Canary Islands runway, killing 583 people on board. The captain on one of the planes, a KLM flight, had misunderstood air traffic control instructions conveying that he was not cleared for takeoff on the runway, and disregarded the second officer, who recognized that the instructions were unclear. There was, in fact, a Pan American flight taking off in the opposite direction on the same runway. Is he not cleared, that Pan American? The second officer said to the captain. Oh, yes, the captain insisted, and continued onto the runway. The captain was wrong. The second officer sensed it, but they were not prepared for this moment. They had not taken the steps to make themselves a team. As a result, the second officer never believed he had the permission, let alone the duty, to halt the captain and clear up the confusion. Instead, the captain was allowed to plow ahead and kill them all. The fear people have about the idea of adherence to protocol is rigidity. They imagine mindless automatons, heads down in a checklist, incapable of looking out their windshield and coping with the real world in front of them. But what you find, when a checklist is well made, is exactly the opposite. The checklist gets the dumb stuff out of the way, the routines your brain shouldn't have to occupy itself with. Are the elevator controls set? Did the patient get her antibiotics on time? Did the managers sell all their shares? Is everyone on the same page here? And lets it rise above to focus on the hard stuff. Where should we land? Here are the details of one of the sharpest checklists I've seen. A checklist for engine failure during flight in a single-engine Cessna airplane, the U.S. Airways situation, only with a solo pilot. It is slimmed down to 6 key steps not to miss for restarting the engine. Steps like making sure the fuel shutoff valve is in the open position and putting the backup fuel pump switch is on. But step 1 on the list is the most fascinating. It is simply fly the airplane. Because pilots sometimes become so desperate trying to restart their engine, so crushed by the cognitive overload of thinking through what could have gone wrong, they forget this most basic task. Fly the airplane. This isn't rigidity. This is making sure everyone has their best shot at survival. About 90 seconds after takeoff, U.S. Airways Flight 1549 was climbing up through 3,000 feet when it crossed the path of the geese. The plane came upon the geese so suddenly, Sullenberger's immediate reaction was to duck. The sound of the birds hitting the windshield and the engines was loud enough to be heard on the cockpit voice recorder. As news reports later pointed out, planes have hit hundreds of thousands of birds without incident. But dual bird strikes are rare. And in any case, jet engines are made to handle most birds, more or less liquefying them. Canadian geese, however, are larger than most birds, often 10 pounds and up, and no engine can handle them. Jet engines are designed instead to shut down after ingesting one, without exploding or sending metal shrapnel into the wings or the passengers on board. That's precisely what the A320's engines did when they were hit with the rarest of rare situations. At least 3 geese in the 2 engines. They immediately lost power. Once that happened, Sullenberger made 2 key decisions. First, to take over flying the airplane from his co-pilot, Skiles, and second, to land in the Hudson. Both seemed clear choices at the time and were made almost instinctively. Within a minute, it became apparent that the plane had too little speed to make it to LaGuardia or to the runway in Teterboro, New Jersey, offered by air traffic control. As for taking over the piloting, both he and Skiles had decades of flight experience, but Sullenberger had logged far more hours flying the A320. All the key landmarks to avoid hitting, Manhattan skyscrapers, the George Washington Bridge, were out his left side window. And Skiles had also just completed A320 emergency training and was more recently familiar with the checklist they would need. "My aircraft," Sullenberger said, using the standard language as he put his hands on the controls. "Your aircraft," Skiles replied. There was no argument about what to do next, not even a discussion, and there was no need for one. The pilot's preparations had made them a team. Sullenberger would look for the nearest, safest possible landing site. Skiles would go to the engine failure checklists and see if he could relight the engines. But for the computerized voice of the ground proximity warning system saying, "Pull up, pull up, pull up, pull up," the cockpit was virtually silent as each pilot concentrated on his tasks and observed the other for cues that kept them coordinated. Both men played crucial roles here. We treat co-pilots as if they were superfluous, backups who are given a few tasks so that they have something to do. But given the complexity of modern airplanes, they are as integral to a successful flight as the anesthesiologists are to a successful operation. Pilot and co-pilot alternate taking the flight controls and managing the flight equipment and checklist responsibilities, and when things go wrong, it's not at all clear which is the harder job. The plane had only 3.5 minutes of glide in it. In that time, Skiles needed to make sure he'd done everything possible to relight the engines while also preparing the aircraft for ditching if it wasn't feasible. But the steps required just to restart one engine typically take more time than that. He had some choices to make. Plunging out of the sky, he judged that their best chance at survival would come from getting an engine restarted. So he decided to focus almost entirely on the engine failure checklist and running through it as fast as he could. The extent of damage to the engines was unknown, but regaining even partial power would have been sufficient to get the plane to an airport. In the end, Skiles managed to complete a restart attempt on both engines, something investigators later testified to be very remarkable in the time frame he had, and something they found difficult to replicate in simulation. Yet he did not ignore the ditching procedure either. He did not have time to do everything on the checklist, but he got the distress signal sent, and he made sure the plane was properly configured for an emergency water landing. "Flaps out?" asked Sullenberger. "Got flaps out," responded Skiles. Sullenberger focused on the glide down to the water, but even in this, he was not on his own. For, as journalist and pilot William Longavisha noted afterward, the plane's fly-by-wire control system was designed to assist pilots in accomplishing a perfect glide without demanding unusual skills. It eliminated drift and wobble. It automatically coordinated the rudder with the roll of the wings. It gave Sullenberger a green dot on his screen to target for optimal descent, and it maintained the ideal angle to achieve lift while preventing the plane from accidentally reaching radical angles during flight that would have caused it to lose its gliding ability. The system freed him to focus on other critical tasks, like finding a landing site near ferries in order to give passengers their best chance of rescue, and keeping the wings level as the plane hit the water's surface. Meanwhile, the three flight attendants in the cabin, Sheila Dale, Donna Dent, and Doreen Welsh, followed through on their protocols for such situations. They had the passengers put their heads down and grab their legs to brace for impact. Upon landing and seeing water through the windows, the flight attendants gave instructions to don life vests. They made sure the doors got open swiftly when the plane came to a halt, that passengers didn't waste time grabbing for their belongings or trap themselves by inflating life vests inside the aircraft. Welsh, stationed in the very back, had to wade through ice-cold chest-high water leaking in through the torn fuselage to do her part. Just 2 of the 4 exits were safely accessible. Nonetheless, working together, they got everyone out of a potentially sinking plane in just 3 minutes, exactly as designed. While the evacuation got underway, Sullenberger headed back to check on the passengers and the condition of the plane. Meanwhile, Skiles remained up in the cockpit to run the evacuation checklist, making sure potential fire hazards were dealt with, for instance. Only when it was completed did he emerge. The arriving flotilla of ferries and boats proved more than sufficient to get everyone out of the water. Air in the fuel tanks, which were only partly full, kept the plane stable and afloat. Sullenberger had time for one last check of the plane. He walked the aisle to make sure no one had been forgotten, and then he exited himself. The entire event had gone shockingly smoothly. After the plane landed, Sullenberger told the press, "First Officer Jeff Skiles and I turned to each other, and almost in unison, at the same time with the same words, said to each other, 'Well, that wasn't as bad as I thought.'" So who was the hero here? No question, there was something miraculous about this flight. Luck played a huge role. The incident occurred in daylight, allowing the pilots to spot a safe landing site. Plenty of boats were nearby for quick rescue before hypothermia set in. The bird strike was sufficiently high to let the plane clear the George Washington Bridge. The plane was also headed downstream with the current, instead of upstream or over the ocean, limiting damage on landing. Nonetheless, even with fortune on their side, there remained every possibility that 155 people could have been lost that day. But what rescued them was something more exceptional, difficult, crucial, and yes, heroic, than flight ability. The crew of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 showed an ability to adhere to vital procedures when it mattered most, to remain calm under pressure, to recognize where one needed to improvise and where one needed not to improvise. They understood how to function in a complex and dire situation. They recognized that it required teamwork and preparation, and that it required them long before the situation became complex and dire. This was what was unusual. This is what it means to be a hero in the modern era. These are the rare qualities that we must understand are needed in the larger world. All learned occupations have a definition of professionalism, a code of conduct. It is where they spell out their ideals and duties. The codes are sometimes stated, sometimes just understood, but they all have at least three common elements. First is an expectation of selflessness, that we who accept responsibility for others, whether we are doctors, lawyers, teachers, public authorities, soldiers, or pilots, we'll place the needs and concerns of those who depend on us above our own. Second is an expectation of skill, that we will aim for excellence in our knowledge and expertise. Third is an expectation of trustworthiness, that we will be responsible in our personal behavior toward our charges. Aviators, however, add a fourth expectation, discipline. Discipline in following prudent procedure and in functioning with others. This is a concept almost entirely outside the lexicon of most professions, including my own. In medicine, we hold up autonomy as a professional lodestar, a principle that stands in direct opposition to discipline. But in a world in which success now requires large enterprises, teams of clinicians, high-risk technologies, and knowledge that outstrips any one person's abilities, individual autonomy hardly seems the ideal we should aim for. It has the ring more of protectionism than of excellence. The closest our professional codes come to articulating the goal is an occasional plea for collegiality. What is needed, however, isn't just that people working together be nice to each other. It is discipline. Discipline is hard, harder than trustworthiness and skill, and perhaps even than selflessness. We are by nature flawed and inconstant creatures. We can't even keep from snacking between meals. We are not built for discipline. We are built for novelty and excitement, not for careful attention to detail. Discipline is something we have to work at. That's perhaps why aviation has required institutions to make discipline a norm. The pre-flight checklist began as an invention of a handful of Army pilots in the 1930s. But the power of their discovery gave birth to entire organizations. In the United States, we now have the National Transportation Safety Board to study accidents, to independently determine the underlying causes and recommend how to remedy them. And we have national regulations to ensure that those recommendations are incorporated into usable checklists and reliably adopted in ways that actually reduce harm. To be sure, checklists must not become ossified mandates that hinder rather than help. Even the simplest requires frequent revisitation and ongoing refinement. Airline manufacturers put a publication date on all their checklists, and there is a reason why. They are expected to change with time. In the end, a checklist is only an aid. If it doesn't aid, it's not right. But if it does, we must be ready to embrace the possibility. We have most readily turned to the computer as our aid. Computers hold out the prospect of automation as our bulwark against failure. Indeed, they can take huge numbers of tasks off our hands, and thankfully already have. Tasks of calculation, processing, storage, transmission. Without question, technology can increase our capabilities. But there is much that technology cannot do. Deal with the unpredictable. Manage uncertainty. Construct a soaring building. Perform a life-saving operation. In many ways, technology has complicated these matters. It has added yet another element of complexity to the systems we depend on and given us entirely new kinds of failure to contend with. One essential characteristic of modern life is that we all depend on systems, on assemblages of people or technologies or both, and among our most profound difficulties is making them work. In medicine, for instance, if I want my patients to receive the best care possible, not only must I do a good job, but a whole collection of diverse components have to somehow mesh together effectively. Healthcare is like a car that way, points out Donald Berwick, president for the Institute of Healthcare Improvement in Boston, and one of our deepest thinkers about systems in medicine. In both cases, having great components is not enough. We're obsessed in medicine with having great components, the best drugs, the best devices, the best specialists, but pay little attention to how to make them fit together well. Berwick notes how wrong-headed this approach is. Anyone who understands systems will know immediately that optimizing parts is not a good route to system excellence, he says. He gives the example of a famous thought experiment of trying to build the world's greatest car by assembling the world's greatest car parts. We connect the engine of a Ferrari, the brakes of a Porsche, the suspension of a BMW, the body of a Volvo. What we get, of course, is nothing close to a great car. We get a pile of very expensive junk. Nonetheless, in medicine, that's exactly what we have done. We have a $30 billion a year National Institutes of Health, which has been a remarkable powerhouse of medical discoveries. But we have no National Institute of Health Systems Innovation alongside it, studying how best to incorporate these discoveries into daily practice. No NTSB equivalent swooping in to study failures the way crash investigators do. No Boeing mapping out the checklists. No agency tracking the month-to-month results. The same can be said in numerous other fields. We don't study routine failures in teaching, in law, in government programs, in the financial industry, or elsewhere. We don't look for the patterns of our recurrent mistakes or devise and refine potential solutions for them. But we could, and this is the ultimate point. We are all plagued by failures, by missed subtleties, overlooked knowledge, and outright errors. For the most part, we have imagined that little can be done beyond working harder and harder to catch the problems and clean up after them. We are not in the habit of thinking the way the Army pilots did as they looked upon their shiny new Model 299 bomber, a machine so complex no one was sure human beings could fly it. They too could have decided just to try harder, or to dismiss a crash as the failings of a weak pilot. Instead, they chose to accept their fallibilities. They recognized the simplicity and power of using a checklist. And so can we. Indeed, against the complexity of the world, we must. There is no other choice. When we look closely, we recognize the same balls being dropped over and over, even by those of great ability and determination. We know the patterns. We see the costs. It's time to try something else. Try a checklist. Chapter 9. The Save. In the spring of 2007, as soon as our surgery checklist began taking form, I began using it in my own operations. I did so not because I thought it was needed, but because I wanted to make sure it was really usable. Also, I did not want to be a hypocrite. We were about to trot this thing out in 8 cities around the world. I had better be using it myself. But in my heart of hearts, If you strapped me down and threatened to take out my appendix without anesthesia unless I told the truth, did I think the checklist would make much of a difference in my cases? No. In my cases? Please. To my chagrin, however, I have yet to go through a week in surgery without the checklists leading us to catch something we would have missed. Take last week, as I write this, for instance. We had 3 catches in 5 cases. I had a patient who hadn't gotten the antibiotic she should have received before the incision, which is one of our most common catches. The anesthesia team had gotten distracted by the usual vicissitudes. They had trouble finding a good vein for an IV, and one of the monitors was being twitchy. Then the nurse called a timeout for the team to run the before incision check. "Has the antibiotic been given within the last 60 minutes?" I asked, reading my lines off a wall poster. "Oh, right. Yes, it will be," the anesthesia resident replied. We waited a quiet minute for the medication to flow in before the scrub tech handed over the knife. I had another patient who specifically didn't want the antibiotic. Antibiotics gave her intestinal upset and yeast infection, she said. She understood the benefits, but the risk of a bacterial wound infection in her particular operation was low, about 1%, and she was willing to take her chances. Yet giving an antibiotic was so automatic, when we weren't distracted from it, that we twice nearly infused it into her, despite her objections. The first time was before she went to sleep, and she caught the error herself. The second time was after, and the checklist caught it. As we went around the room at the pause before the incision, making sure no one had any concerns, the nurse reminded everyone not to give the antibiotic. The anesthesia attending reacted with surprise. She hadn't been there for the earlier conversation and was about to drip it in. The third catch involved a woman in her 60s, for whom I was doing a neck operation to remove half of her thyroid because of potential cancer. She'd had her share of medical problems and required a purse full of medications to keep them under control. She'd also been a long-time heavy smoker, but had quit a few years before. There seemed to be no significant lingering effects. She could climb 2 flights of stairs without shortness of breath or chest pain. She looked generally well. Her lungs sounded clear and without wheezes under my stethoscope. The record showed no pulmonary diagnoses. But when she met the anesthesiologist before surgery, she remembered that she'd had trouble breathing after 2 previous operations and had required oxygen at home for several weeks. In one instance, she'd required a stay in intensive care. This was a serious concern. The anesthesiologist knew about it, but I didn't, not until we ran the checklist. When the moment came to raise concerns, the anesthesiologist asked why I wasn't planning to watch her longer than the usual few hours after day surgery, given her previous respiratory problems. "What respiratory problems?" I said. The full story came out from there. We made arrangements to keep the patient in the hospital for observation. Moreover, we made plans to give her inhalers during surgery and afterward to prevent breathing problems. They worked beautifully. She never needed extra oxygen at all. No matter how routine an operation is, the patients never seem to be. But with the checklist in place, we have caught unrecognized drug allergies, equipment problems, confusion about medications, mistakes on labels for biopsy specimens going to pathology. No, that one is from the right side. This is the one from the left side. We've made better plans and have been better prepared for patients. I am not sure how many important issues would have slipped by us without the checklist and actually caused harm. We were not bereft of defenses. Our usual effort to be vigilant and attentive might have caught some of the problems, and those we didn't catch may never have gone on to hurt anyone. I had one case, however, in which I know for sure the checklist saved my patient's life. Mr. Hagerman, as we'll call him, was a 53-year-old father of 2 and the CEO of a local company, and I had brought him to the operating room to remove his right adrenal gland because of an unusual tumor growing inside it called a pheochromocytoma. Tumors like his pour out dangerous levels of adrenaline, and can be difficult to remove. They are also exceedingly rare. But in recent years, I've developed alongside my general surgery practice a particular interest and expertise in endocrine surgery. I've now removed somewhere around 40 adrenal tumors without complication. So when Mr. Hagerman came to see me about this strange mass in his right adrenal gland, I felt quite confident about my ability to help him. There is always a risk of serious complications, I explained. The primary danger occurs when you're taking the gland off the vena cava, the main vessel returning blood to the heart, because injuring the vena cava can cause life-threatening bleeding. But the likelihood was low, I reassured him. Once you're in the operating room, however, you either have a complication or you don't. And with him, I did. I was doing the operation laparoscopically, freeing the tumor with instruments I observed on a video monitor, using a fiber-optic camera we put inside Mr. Hagerman. All was going smoothly. I was able to lift the liver up and out of the way, and underneath I found the soft, tan-yellow mass, like the yolk of a hard-boiled egg. I began dissecting it free of the vena cava, and although doing so was painstaking, it didn't seem unusually difficult. I'd gotten the tumor mostly separated when I did something I'd never done before. I made a tear in the vena cava. This is a catastrophe. I might as well have made a hole directly in Mr. Hagerman's heart. The bleeding that resulted was terrifying. He lost almost his entire volume of blood into his abdomen in about 60 seconds and went into cardiac arrest. I made a huge slashing incision to open his chest and belly as fast and wide as I could. I took his heart in my hand and began compressing it. 1, 2, 3, squeeze. 1, 2, 3, squeeze. To keep his blood flow going to his brain. The resident assisting me held pressure on the vena cava to slow the torrent. But in the grip of my fingers, I could feel the heart emptying out. I thought it was over, that we'd never get Mr. Hagerman out of the operating room alive, that I had killed him. But we had run the checklist at the start of the case. When we had come to the part where I was supposed to discuss how much blood loss the team should be prepared for, I said, "I don't expect much blood loss. I've never lost more than 100 cc's. I was confident. I was looking forward to this operation. But I added that the tumor was pressed right up against the vena cava and that significant blood loss remained at least a theoretical concern. The nurse took that as a cue to check that 4 units of packed red cells had been set aside in the blood bank, like they were supposed to be, just in case, as she said. They hadn't been, it turned out. So the blood bank got the 4 units ready. And as a result, from this one step alone, the checklist saved my patient's life. Just as powerful, though, was the effect that the routine of the checklist, the discipline, had on us. Of all the people in the rooms as we started that operation, the anesthesiologist, the nurse anesthetist, the surgery resident, the scrub nurse, the circulating nurse, the medical student, I had worked with only 2 before, and I knew only the resident well. But as we went around the room introducing ourselves, Atul Gawande, surgeon, Rich Bafford, surgery resident, Sue Twardy, nurse, you could feel the room snapping to attention. We confirmed the patient's name on his ID bracelet, and that we all agreed which adrenal gland was supposed to come out. The anesthesiologist confirmed that he had no critical issues to mention before starting, and so did the nurses. We made sure that the antibiotics were in the patient, a warming blanket was on his body, the inflating boots were on his legs to keep blood clots from developing. We came into the room as strangers. But when the knife hit the skin, we were a team. As a result, when I made the tear and put disaster upon us, everyone kept their head. The circulating nurse called an alarm for extra personnel and got the blood from the blood bank almost instantly. The anesthesiologist began pouring unit after unit into the patient. Forces were marshaled to bring in the additional equipment I requested, to page the vascular surgeon I wanted, to assist the anesthesiologist with obtaining more intravenous access, to keep the blood bank apprised. and together the team got me and the patient precious time. They ended up transfusing more than 30 units of blood into him. He lost 3 times as much blood as his body contained to begin with. And with our eyes on the monitor tracing his blood pressure and my hand squeezing his heart, it proved enough to keep his circulation going. The vascular surgeon and I had time to work out an effective way to clamp off the vena cava tear. I could feel his heart begin beating on its own again. We were able to put in sutures and close the hole. And Mr. Hagerman survived. I cannot pretend he escaped unscathed. The extended period of low blood pressure damaged an optic nerve and left him essentially blind in one eye. He didn't get off the respirator for days. He was out of work for months. I was crushed by what I had put him through. Though I apologized to him and carried on with my daily routine, it took me a long time to feel right again in surgery. I can't do an adrenalectomy without thinking of his case, and I suspect that is good. I have even tried refining the operative technique in hopes of coming up with better ways to protect the vena cava and keep anything like his experience from happening again. But more than this, because of Mr. Hagerman's operation, I have come to be grateful for what a checklist can do. I do not like to think how much worse the case could have been. I do not like to think about having to walk out to that family waiting area and explain to his wife that her husband had died. I spoke to Mr. Hagerman not long ago. He had sold his company with great success and was in the process of turning another company around. He was running 3 days a week. He was even driving. "I have to watch out for my blind spot, but I can manage," he said. He had no bitterness, no anger, and this is remarkable to me. "I count myself lucky just to be alive," he insisted. I asked him if I could have permission to tell others his story. "Yes," he said. "I'd be glad if you did."
We hope you've enjoyed The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right, a Macmillan audio production from Henry Holton Company. Text copyright 2009 by Atul Gawande. Production copyright 2009 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.